Courtney. Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. A report released recently by UNICEF warns that babies who are not breastfed within the first hour of life are at greater risk of dying. It says 77% of newborns worldwide, that's one in two babies, are not put to the breast immediately, depriving them of essential and life-saving nutrients and antibodies. And sub-Saharan Africa is one of particular concern region. On the program today, we will discuss breastfeeding and other related women's health issues. To discuss the issue of breastfeeding, I spoke to Anne Pfizer, an expert in family planning and newborn health with USAID's Maternal and Child Survival Program. Here is our discussion. Take a listen. So, Anne, what can you tell us in terms of what the message is today when we talk about breastfeeding, especially when it comes to women in developing countries?
Well, I think there are three important criteria, or important elements of breastfeeding that we're trying to promote for maximum benefits, health benefits of mothers and children. The first is to establish breastfeeding early, soon after birth, within 30 minutes or an hour at the most. Then it's to encourage women to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months. The breast milk has the optimal nutrition has everything that babies need, and there's no need to supplement with other liquids or foods. And then lastly, it's to continue breastfeeding until the child is at least 2 years, because the continued nutrition brought by breastfeeding is important to the child's growth and development. So there are really three components that are promoted when we say we want to promote breastfeeding in low-resource settings.
Breastfeeding is something very basic that many women do almost everywhere in the world. It has been done for many, many years. So why is it that is being promoting today in a particular way, given that it seems to be a natural part of cultures everywhere, or at least habits everywhere?
You're right. Breastfeeding has been with us since the beginning of time, and it is part of a lot of the cultures in low-resource countries. But it's not always done optimally. It doesn't always follow those three components I described. There are many cultural beliefs and practices around breastfeeding that can vary from one place to another. And the work of UNICEF and other international experts has shown that there's varying rates of both early initiation of breastfeeding or exclusive breastfeeding for the required 6 months. And so these variations give researchers and experts in the health field some pause, some concerns that the optimal practices are not being implemented with every baby and every mother.
You're raising a good point, because a UNICEF report released recently said that breastfeeding practices in sub-Saharan Africa is of particular concern. So what is the concern?
The concern is that it's low. It's less than 50%, for example, who are exclusively breastfeeding for 6 months. The rate of early initiation was even lower in some regions in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is, in a region that is rapidly growing, has a population growth rate that is beyond any other region. So it's in a region that can really not afford to miss out on the health benefits of good breastfeeding.
Let's talk about HIV/AIDS, because this is something that has come up different times and in different ways with different messages. What are some of the myths and facts around breastfeeding mothers who are HIV positive?
Well, in this day and age, most countries now have programs to prevent the transmission of HIV from mothers to baby. HIV does pass through breast milk, but most countries will give women who attend antenatal care a test to check for HIV status, either at the time of antenatal care or at the time of birth. And as soon as a woman is identified as living with HIV, she should be offered antiretroviral therapy that will prevent the transmission of the virus through either breast milk or at the time of birth. So it's really critical for women who are living with the virus to take those medication as prescribed while they're breastfeeding their infants. But the recommendations remain that to have all infants breastfed exclusively for 6 months, whether the woman is living with HIV or not.
Speaking specifically about women in Africa, what are some of the most common barriers to breastfeeding that African women face?
Well, it varies, I'm sure, from place to place and country to country, but there are many ways that women perhaps do not practice optimal breastfeeding. If we're talking about the early initiation, it may be that in hospital settings, the baby is separated from the mother, and that doesn't allow the mother and baby to take advantage of that instinct that babies are born with to root and to find the breast and to start breastfeeding immediately. Mm-hmm. So there's a worldwide initiative called the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative that tries to combat those negative practices and make sure that women and babies are kept together and that breastfeeding is established as early as possible. There are other reasons for why women may not continue to exclusively breastfeeding in very hot climates, for example. Okay. People often think that they need to give water or other liquids to babies because they will not get enough fluids from breast milk, which is incorrect. But you see that they do supplement with water, especially in West Africa, it tends to be water. And that could potentially introduce other pathogens to the baby, or just if it's actual food that they're giving, make the baby less hungry and start a vicious cycle where the baby is less hungry, doesn't suckle as hard, so the mother's milk production is affected, and it gets very difficult to reestablish exclusive breastfeeding.
And there is a lot of emphasis on immediate breastfeeding. Why is breastfeeding in the first hour of life so important for both mother and baby?
The longer one delays in starting to breastfeed, the harder it is to really establish that exclusive breastfeeding on the one part. On the other part, there's been a number of scientific study reviews that have shown that there's a higher rate of newborn death when breastfeeding is delayed. And that is especially true when that delayed breastfeeding also prevents exclusive breastfeeding from being established. So starting early and ensuring that the mother is able to breastfeed successfully is critical to her being able to breastfeed exclusively and to prevent some of those other complications.
Now, what are some of the most important interventions that you are seeing in Africa that support new mothers so that they are able to continue breastfeeding their infants, and how effective are these interventions?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the work that the Maternal and Child Survival Program is doing, for example, in Kenya. Earlier, I spoke about the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, which is something that's been around for a while that UNICEF is leading on. We're working on Baby-Friendly Community Initiative, which takes some of the teaching about breastfeeding out of the facility and into communities. It works through community health workers. It puts together groups of women to share their experience on how they're going through the services from the time of pregnancy to how to prepare for birth, how to establish good breastfeeding, and then once the baby is born, share tips on how to manage some of the challenges they're facing. And these groups are facilitated by workers who've been trained on how to support breastfeeding mothers overcome some of the difficulties. And some women will have difficulties and will need that extra support. So it provides an avenue to offer that support at the right time.
Are you seeing the tide turning for the better, of course, in some countries?
Well, I have to confess I haven't done an exhaustive review of all the countries, but okay. I did see some data recently from Ghana that seems to have made some progress in increasing rates of exclusive breastfeeding. I think Kenya is also making some great strides, which are really encouraging given the work that we've been doing there and the close engagement we have with the Ministry of Health. And there's strong support and leadership in this area. It's I think, starting to show some results in terms of the indicators. So that's gratifying. I think more work needs to be done. And as MCSP, I think we're looking to places like Malawi and other countries to take some of these initiatives forward.
One theme that was put at the forefront during Breastfeeding Week this year is how nursing is good for sustainable development. We know it's good for a baby's development, but how do we make the case for the economic aspect of it?
Well, I think there are multiple ways. The proper way to feed your child with exclusive breastfeeding at first and then introducing a good diet at the age of 6 months is linked to reducing malnutrition and preventing undernutrition and malnutrition. By preventing and saving costs on treating malnutrition, that definitely saves resources for the country. But breastfeeding has also been recently shown to have beneficial effects on learning, on cognitive development of children. Kids who have been breastfed tend to perform better in school, and that in itself has some links to making the country more productive and to economic development. So there are multiple ways that breastfeeding can benefit the development of a nation. Myself, as a family planning practitioner, particularly interested in the link between exclusive breastfeeding and suppression of fertility, because I think it can also help with birth spacing and preventing unplanned pregnancies too soon after the previous birth or baby. And that in itself has also been shown to have effects on development. The analysis by UNICEF in The Lancet, I think, came up with a figure of $300 billion annually worldwide in potential cost benefits of practicing optimal breastfeeding across the world. That's enormous, you know, and some of it is also savings of managing infectious disease, which is much more common in children who are not breastfed.
And before we finish, there are some women that are not able to breastfeed. A lot of times it's for medical reasons. What do we say to these women? What do they do?
It is true that there are women who will be challenged to exclusively breastfeed or breastfeed at all. Some of those challenges can be overcome with the right support, and even I am told there are some medications now that can help with some of these problems, but those are not widely available. I think every woman should try and breastfeed and should try and breastfeed with every baby, not, you know, even if they had difficulty with the last baby, they should try again with the next one, but it's not the end of the world. As long as a baby is well cared for and provided good nutrition, you know, we know it's not the worst thing if really medically it's too difficult.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, breastfeeding is incredibly life-saving and, as we just said, cost-saving an intervention. Again, my interest is on the contraceptive effects of exclusive breastfeeding in the first 6 months and the role of the contraceptive method that we call LAM, or lactational amenorrhea method, and how we're really struggling to get more women to understand that method and how their breastfeeding practices can protect them from pregnancy in the first 6 months, but also the importance of understanding they need another method of contraception when they stop exclusively breastfeeding or if their menses come back. So we're organizing an event, an innovation design challenge of unlike minds or people from all sorts of walks of life and discipline to try and help us overcome some of these challenges in low-resource settings. That's going to be happening in Baltimore in October. It's posted on our website. So I hope some of your listeners who are interested in this question and interested in affecting change for women in places like Africa will consider joining us in Baltimore.
Great. Thank you so much, Anne Feitzer, for joining us today.
Thank you, Lenora. It's been a pleasure.
And that was Anne Feitzer, expert in family planning and newborn health with USAID's Maternal and Child Survival Program. It is now time to take a break, but first, a quick roundup of the latest health news with Eva Yuma.
A new study suggests 1 in 10 children have a monkey-like immune system that stops them from developing AIDS. The researchers analyzed the blood of 170 children from South Africa who had HIV, had never had antiretroviral therapy, and yet hadn't developed AIDS. The study in Science Translational Medicine found the children's immune systems were keeping calm, which prevented them being wiped out. An untreated HIV infection will kill 60% of children within 2.5 years, but the equivalent infection in monkeys is not fatal. The findings could lead to new immune-based therapies for HIV infection. Leading doctors and veterinarians warn that animal tuberculosis is a greater threat to human health than previously realized. The group of experts from institutions including the World Health Organization, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, and the Stop TB Partnership say the disease can be more serious and harder to treat than conventional human tuberculosis. It's spread through contaminated food, and raw or unpasteurized milk is one of the most common sources of the infection. Animal tuberculosis, officially known as zoonotic tuberculosis, also affects those in close contact with infected animals, including veterinarians, farmers, and butchers. The experts published a call to action in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Medical Journal. And finally, the 2016 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine goes to Dr. Yoshinori Osumi of Japan for discoveries about the secrets of how cells can remain healthy by recycling waste. He located genes that regulate the cellular self-eating process, known as autophagy, a natural defense that our bodies use to survive, such as fighting off invading bacteria and viruses. Failure of autophagy is linked with many diseases of old age, including dementia. Medical experts say Dr. Osumi's work is important because it helps explain what goes wrong in a range of illnesses, from cancer to Parkinson's. And that's a wrap-up of the latest health news.
Welcome back to Health Chat. If you're just joining us, today we are discussing breastfeeding and other women's health-related issues. Now, the global community is encouraging efforts for women's political, economic, and social progress. Many such efforts are included in the 17 Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations adopted by member countries of the UN. VOA's reporter William Bill Eagle looks at the importance of the goals in achieving gender equality and the empowerment of women.
The Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, build on the UN's 8 Millennium Development Goals for developing countries, which ended in 2015. They sought to improve social and economic conditions with large reductions in poverty and hunger. They also sought to promote health and education of especially women and children, and curbing malaria, HIV, and other diseases. The 17 SDGs, which end in 2030, include the unfinished business of the Millennium Development Goals, and add other areas such as coping with climate change, promoting clean water and sanitation, and promoting living standards, innovation, and economic growth. UN officials say the SDGs attempt to include the needs of marginalized groups the world over, including women. For example, Goal 11 supports sustainable cities and includes efforts to make urban areas safe for women. Diana Afuana is the Regional Director for West and Central Africa and also Acting Director for Eastern and Southern Africa for the group UN Women. She gave several examples where investments in public infrastructure, inclusion of women in politics, passing legislation that enhances women's rights, as well as implementing affirmative financing programs, have gone a long way in transforming the lives of women and, by extension, their families and the economy as a whole.
We have found through our Safe Cities program, when we sensitize policymakers, the mayors and the city planners, when we sensitize them to things as basic as better lighting, when we sensitize the security organs, you know, to provide security and safety, it ensures the security and the safety of our women and girls.
The SDGs also contain indicators that ensure that women have a role in disaster management and relief efforts. Afona stresses the importance of including women's views in all post-disaster and reconstruction efforts, including in camp management, which is usually left to men. In one instance, she says, a camp management team had not taken into account the fact that breastfeeding mothers need a special diet. After a week, they had no more breast milk for their infants, causing stress, anxiety, and hunger-related ailments to both the children and mothers. She said water at the camp was running low, and mothers had problems nourishing themselves and their children.
The worst part of it was that the food that they were getting was maize and beans. Now, for a lactating mother, you actually need more than that. You need milk, you need porridge, you need, So after some days, the women were not able to lactate, and there was no water. And when we visited the camp, the babies were crying incessantly. It was very difficult. It was actually quite a crisis. And when we looked, we asked the camp managers, you know, what's the problem? And they said they didn't understand it.
She says, had women been included in the camp management team, the problem probably would have been identified earlier in the process. The SDGs also promote women's participation and leadership in politics. In some countries, UN Women has supported advocacy efforts for quotas. It has also trained women candidates before elections in parliamentary caucusing, confidence building, and debating skills so they can better advocate for pro-women legislation. UN Women has also supported the setting up of so-called women's situation rooms before, during, and after elections. Afuana says this has been done in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Senegal, Nigeria, and more recently in Uganda.
These situation rooms are actually a physical space with a 24-hour call center, usually manned by youth volunteers, girls, women. And the women's situation rooms receive reports on a minute-by-minute basis from all districts and all counties that we've identified as hotspots. And there's also an analysis of the political situation before, during, and after the election.
The women's situation rooms comprise prominent women from different African countries who enjoy stature and moral authority. They meet with government officials, political parties, candidates for elections, as well as security organs, women's groups, and civil society. They also help to broker peace and consensus in deadlocks, preempt potential violence or conflict, and provide for the participation and safety of women voters and candidates. Afuana credits them with helping to avert crises, cooling tempers, and brokering peace between warring factions. Women's support groups say it's just one of the examples of the benefits of promoting women in all spheres of political, economic, and social life to foster sustainable development. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
You're listening to Health Chat, and we continue to look at breastfeeding. Voice of America's Jessica Berman reports on breastfeeding and HIV/AIDS risk. Take a listen.
Breastfeeding is widely regarded as the best form of nutrition for newborns because human milk transfers not only essential nutrients, but also important immune system factors from mother to child, protecting the baby against potentially life-threatening infections. But Louise Kuhn of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York says there's always been some controversy about breastfeeding by HIV-infected mothers since the virus virus that causes AIDS can also be transmitted through breast milk. Public health experts estimate that HIV-infected mothers have a 10 to 15% chance of passing the virus to their newborns through their breast milk. Kuhn and her colleagues wanted to find out if changes in breastfeeding routines would affect the levels of HIV in their breast milk. They studied just over 950 HIV-infected women in Lusaka, Zambia in 2006, before antiretroviral drugs were given to nursing mothers, and encouraged them to exclusively breastfeed their babies from birth for at least 4 months. Throughout the study, the newborns were regularly tested for HIV. At the 4-month mark, half of the mothers were asked to stop nursing, while the other half continued to breastfeed exclusively. At 4.5 months, Kuhn says, samples of breast milk were collected from all of the study participants and analyzed.
We found that stopping breastfeeding early was a really bad idea for several different reasons.
Kuhn says investigators discovered the highest concentrations of HIV in the breast milk of women who had stopped breastfeeding at 4 months. More than 3/4 of them had evidence of the virus in their milk, compared to just under 40% of the women who were still breastfeeding. The two groups of women showed no differences in HIV levels 2 weeks earlier when they were both tested at the 4-month mark. Women in a control group who nursed an average of 16 months and supplemented breastfeeding with other nutrition also had higher HIV concentrations in their milk compared to those who breastfed exclusively beyond 4 months. Investigators believe changes in breast tissue that occurred during sudden weaning could account for higher concentrations of HIV in women who stopped nursing at 4 months. Kuhn says the results show that even subtle decreases in breastfeeding frequency during a child's infancy can increase concentrations of HIV in an infected mother's breast milk. That suggests that it's in the interest of both the mother and child for women to practice exclusive and extended breastfeeding. Kuhn notes that breastfeeding is actually a very inefficient way to transmit the AIDS virus. She says the risk is minimal among mothers who nurse and take antiretroviral drugs at the same time.
If antiretroviral drugs are given and if an HIV-positive woman is fully adherent with the treatment throughout the duration of breastfeeding, the actual risk of transmitting HIV through breast milk is exceedingly low. It's probably in the 1% to 2%, if not lower, with complete adherence with antiretroviral therapy.
An article on reducing the risk of mother-to-child HIV transmission through breast milk is published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. That's today's Health Brief. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us on Health Chat. And we thank our guests today who spoke with us earlier about breastfeeding. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in to Health Chat every Tuesday right here on the Voice of America Radio. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi and today Eva Yuma for the news. If you want to know more about our program, join us on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic,
the one and only African music mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two-Face. Nato C. Hey.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.